Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And Whole Foods might be its own worst enemy. What I mean is, once the leader in selling healthy organic food, they're now fighting to survive competition from Whole Foods knockoffs. Franchises like Walmart and Target are selling organic food at low prices. Whole Foods is trying to distinguish itself with the message that their value to shoppers is through the values they follow in deciding how to stock their shelves. We'll get your thoughts on can Whole Foods cash in on their appeal to the ethical consumer in a minute or two. But first, here with us in Studio 3 for her take on the Whole Foods makeover is Nancy Kane. Nancy is an historian at the Harvard Business School. She holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hello, Nancy.
Hey there.
So I'm dying to know what you think. Will people be willing to spend more money to get more ethical products? What do you think?
I think the answer to that is yes. I think it's a yes that has to be qualified by business cycles and consumers getting more sensitive about, you know, their spending and the costs of goods, because in general, ethically sourced goods are more expensive. But I think if you look at the long trajectory of consumption, there's no question that people are increasingly moving to use their dollars for political, social, larger ethical, humanitarian aspects of control. We've given up on government to a large sense. We're cynical about all kinds of what were once historical and traditional avenues of social and political change. And by God, we will use our wallets in a way that we know commands attention, and that is we will vote with our dollars on all kinds of issues and the companies that represent those issues and the backstory of how they do their business.
Who's we, by the way, before you continue? Is we upper middle class people who can afford to
be
ethical consumers?
We is millennials, to look at a mainstream huge cohort of consumers now exercising their agency in the marketplace. We is, you know, in many ways, you know, market researchers want to say we is urban folks with, you know, yuppie proclivities in blue states. But that's way too simplistic, because if you can survey, and I know some about this because of the work I do with all kinds of interesting advertising folks who know these kind of questions, you know, as experts, you can survey a broad cross section of consumers now and find, for example, middle class and what urban elites might call working class, a term I find a little bit condescending, but folks who hold two jobs, right, and do not necessarily have graduate degrees, where every single mother in the focus group will say, well, I don't buy a lot of organics because they're expensive, but I buy organic milk because I don't want my kids drinking hormones.
See the reaction from Marjorie Egan over here to this?
So organic milk, for
That's
example,
how just, I started.
Just to take a category, is not something that a lot of consumers think about as a nice to have, but rather a must have. And this is true of a lot of different, increasingly true of a lot of different kinds of meat for people. So you have to understand there's nuance because it's not to be buttonholed into a very, very kind of simple, thin file folder. The reason that is true is because we are in the midst of a long-term, very powerful switch in how consumers think about their consumption and their own power as consumers and how they want to exercise that power. And last comment, P.S., corporations that think this isn't the case, right, haven't woken up and smelled the coffee and they're going to pay for it. Look at Walmart, for example, a company that has recently announced a huge, right, advancement into the organic category. By the way, that's one of the companies that analysts, stock market analysts, are nervous will become a rival for Whole Foods business, right, because they for a long time were the standard bearer of organic foods. Walmart's a company that for years and years and years consumer groups, activists, took on because of the way they did business, everything from labor to, you know, where their food came from to, you know, what their environmental footprint was. Walmart's learning this lesson and continues to learn this lesson with, you know, with great results in terms of its own performance in certain categories. So the game is changing, and we want to appreciate the nuance and evolutionary ramifications of that change.
You know, we're talking to Nancy Kane. I was cynical, would have been cynical about your answer that's not just upper middle class, not just yuppies, until I realized, and I didn't know this till the last couple of days, McDonald's, of all places, is now asking questions in their ads. What part of the chicken goes into McNuggets? Do you want hamburgers containing pink slime? They're essentially broadcasting the exact same values message that Whole Foods is trying to do, right?
Absolutely. And the backstory on McDonald's is in terms of its own interest in understanding, right, consumers' interests in these kind of issues is very rich. They are slowly but with great impact because when McDonald's – wouldn't Napoleon once say, you know, when China wakes up, watch out for the world will rock? I mean, when McDonald's starts getting –
Wow.
Something like that. I'm bastardizing it a little bit. McDonald's is a great example of that. The analogy applies to McDonald's. They have in the last 6 to 8 years or maybe the last decade, to be fair, have done all kinds of interesting, very important moves. They have, for example, said they don't want to buy a lot of beef with lots and lots of antibiotics. Well, when McDonald's says that, why cattlemen and meat distributors listen. So step by step, McDonald's, whose consumer research is very, very good, whose focus group work is right on target, are realizing and changing as the consumer changes. So yes, Jim, this is bigger than, you know, 02138, the zip code for Cambridge.
You know what's really – this is totally anecdotal, but I have heard this over and over again. You know, when you have a baby, you usually go to prenatal classes to learn how to breathe and labor and stuff, and there's inevitably discussion about why you should breastfeed instead of bottle feed, which inevitably leads to all the bad things in milk, which inevitably leads to people saying, well, I don't want to feed that bad hormone-laced milk to my baby, which inevitably leads to someone in the class telling a story about little girls getting breasts at like 7 and 8 and 9 years old and menstruating early because they're eating milk full of hormones and meat full of hormones. So you have to think there's millions of women going to prenatal classes hearing this kind of conversation. And that's going to – and who buys the groceries for the most part? It's the moms.
Absolutely. And moms, you know, sitting around, you know, at school events or, you know, waiting in the parking lot to pick up their kids, talking to each other about, you know, did you hear that Hillary or, you know, Jody just got her period at age 9?
Yes.
And I mean, the average age of menarche, as our good listeners know, has fallen precipitously in the last 25 years. This is something that does not – it left to its own devices in natural selection or in, you know, in Darwin's evolution happen in 10 to 25 years. And it has. And it's clear that the culprit, if you will, is large amounts of hormones in our meat, particularly in our milk, that girls are ingesting and our bodies are reacting. So I think that the grapevine that's so very important in determining and affecting consumer behavior is alive and well. And consumers are very, very smart and very adaptive. So I think what we're seeing here around what Whole Foods is trying to do is two things. One, it's Whole Foods trying to continue to lead the market around what emerging consumer priorities. I think that's the first thing. The second thing, very much related to that, is they're trying to reestablish their own position as a market leader, right? In the wake, just like think about Starbucks 5 years ago, in the wake of all kinds of competitors, in Starbucks' case, it was McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts, moving into the area that they created and taking market share away from them. So, not surprising, Whole Foods has a new advertising campaign, a national branding advertising campaign, right? A bigger investment than they've made previously in multimedia advertising. And second, they are doing things like now telling you, they recently announced this, that they will tell you how their flowers and produce were grown. And not just which farmer, the local farmer on the little tab of the Macintosh apples, you know, that tells you where it came from in a Whole Foods store, but how it was grown. So what kind of, you know, what kind of labor standards did that farmer have? What kind of soil management
did
they
use? And are they going to grade it like good, better, best?
They're going to grade
sort of
it good, better, best.
Hold on one second. You know, you talked about this advertising campaign, which they theoretically, arguably, are going to spend $15 to $20 million bucks on, which I think is their biggest ever. I'm not sure.
A very small number, right? The company.
Yes, it is.
Top line is $13 billion.
Here's one of the spots that you will either have heard or will be hearing soon. Listen.
At Whole Foods Market, values matter. So the fresh fruits and vegetables we sell support organic and sustainable farming. Grown locally on over 1,000 U.S. farms and globally with our ethical trade program. Rated for sustainability and grown by people with responsible farming practices. Like Staley Farms Organics. Because to us, value is inseparable from values. Whole Foods Market. America's healthiest grocery store.
Value is inseparable from value.
Those,
that's obviously
the birds at the end there.
The chirping. I don't know what they were. I'd like to say, you know, Margie was bragging a minute ago about the milk thing, etc. I'm going to tell
that's the
truth about my dilemma, and I hope nobody is paying attention. I've turned Margie onto the best apples ever because they're called Honeycrisp apples. We get them at Whole Foods. Here's the problem: they're $3.99 a pound, which is a lot. If they're organic, if no one's paying attention, you can go about 15 feet over and buy them not organic for $3.49, and you save money. What is going to convince people like me who can't afford the extra 50 cents, but I have to admit I'm occasionally in a dilemma, what is it that motivates me? Is it politics? Is it self-celebration? What is it that motivates me to do the right thing and buy the high-quality, value-laden, organic, whatever product?
Well, I'm working on my chapter on Silent Spring, and let me tell you, you start reading about the history of pesticides, and unless you want to peel every single apple you eat and you really think the pesticides don't permeate that skin, that's a pretty self-interested argument for an extra 50 cents a pound that is no pesticides. So yeah. I'm sorry, apples are all about the crunch of biting into the skin for the most part, not excepting really good apple pie or apple crisp. That's another sidebar.
Which she makes, by the way.
But apple crisp in the fall.
Fine.
Yeah. All right, sorry.
Okay.
So let's not get sidetracked. So, but the point is, I think there are all kinds of arguments, right? Do you want to support the kind of farming that organic apples growing represents?
Do you mean small farmers and not the industrial agricultural
or cooperatives of farmers, right? There's an interesting article in the New York Times about this whole issue, folks, that came out, just one second, I'll tell you, October 15th by Stephanie Strom, STROM. And they follow a family farm in Connecticut that's been in operation since the late 18th century. And they grow for Whole Foods. And the farmer talks about where he rated well and where he didn't rate quite so highly. And actually, he says, this was kind of useful for me because it connected me to other farmers and growing practices around soil management.
Which, by the way, my friend who runs FarmAid does. That's one of the things they do is connect family farmers.
Wait, is he the guy that had to count how many earthworms he had in his
soil? I'm not sure. One of the farmers had to count earthworms because earthworms are actually really good, as you all know, dear listeners, for soil conservation and soil aeration, and therefore the lasting value of soil. But in any event, I think about that, and I think about the demise of farming and the demise of our countryside, and I actually think 50 cents is a small price to pay. So very egotistically, I feel a little better about my role in a whole bunch of trends that none of us are so happy about.
But don't go to the second reason yet, because while intellectually I think we totally both agree with you, is we want to support the family farmer, they're local, they're not –
Let's just stay on pesticides.
You know what we just heard this morning? We just heard that Apple has one of the biggest quarters or whatever. What'd they sell? 36 million iPhones in the last quarter? Where are those iPhones made?
China under terrible labor practices.
Exactly. So
Not to mention the environmental effects of all kinds of the chemicals and goods in an iPhone.
Nancy Kane, is if we're willing to continue to buy iPhones at a feverish rate, why are we not going to be hypocrites and continue to say, we love the family farmer, but the big agricultural machine is cheaper?
We're more selfish than we are not selfish. I mean, because you're putting
pesticides
into yourself and your little adorable children, as opposed to doing terrible things that I
and
hate
by
to
the
say
way,
it, to the people that are far away in China.
Back to my historian's hat, it never, right? It always comes out on this show. If the history of consumption is any good indicator here, and I think it is, Apple will have its day in court on this. They already had their day around Foxconn, right? The huge factory where kids were killing themselves because their labor practices were bad. And they cleaned things up. So we're going to see in the next 5 years, they'll clean up more. We're going to see Apple come into the court of public opinion that's all being, you know, if you will, called by activists, online information, consumers being better informed than anyone because companies that now exist in glass houses. They'll be called to account on labor practice, hugely on chemicals and the economics. I mean, the environmental consequences of producing all these consumer electronics. They will be held to account. We'll have to deal with it as consumers as well. But this is just the beginning, folks. This isn't going to end. It's not going to be reversed.
Okay, so what are other reasons, other than the fact that we want to not ingest pesticides, as Marjorie and you say, and that we want to support local or semi-local family farmers as opposed to the big
boys?
I would say
the third reason, this comes out of the work I did and a couple of very good research assistants did with me several years ago, now 6 years ago, on a case I wrote on Whole Foods, which was a public source case. John Mackey, the founder and co-CEO, did not want to participate. I later met him and talked to him a little bit about why he didn't want to talk about his story. He's not crazy about the press. He's less crazy about traditional academics. Anyway, so I did this on a public source basis. But in doing that research, I learned a ton about the history of farming and history of food cultivation. I won't bore you folks and our dear listeners about it. But let me just tell you that in terms of sustainability, there are two huge issues here around the future of the global food supply. One is sustainability and factory farming, talking about meat production, and a lot of factory farming of produce and other goods has huge environmental consequences and health consequences that make all of us question its sustainability. And you just need to take one little passing glance on the internet at Fast Food Nation, Eric Schlosser's, I believe, 2001 book about the way where America's food comes from to understand this. It's a global issue, but more importantly. Second, how are we going to feed everyone? Can we really feed everyone by organic farming? It's not clear that we can do that. So there's kind of the Scylla and Charybdis here of these, if you will, of this issue. But we have to find some way of growing food in a more sustainable way, environmentally, socially, and other ways, particularly environmentally in terms of the ticking clock of the environment. And at the same time, we have to feed a world that has millions, soon to be billions of consumers coming online with larger amounts of disposable income who want the same kind of food that the industrialized world has had now for a century. So this is a really hard nut to crack. But it begins with trying to understand what about organic farming can be made mass and still have real legs of integrity to it. And it begins by consumers saying, I'm not sure I really want to eat Purdue chicken any longer.
By the way, so we're talking to Nancy Kane about the new program, for lack of a better expression, at Whole Foods, the motto of which is, to us, value is inseparable from values.
I did just say on the chicken front, when you roast a chicken that's an all-natural chicken as opposed to one that you buy in a supermarket, the color is different of the – I mean, it's night
try
and
eggs.
Day.
Try eggs as well.
Absolutely right. But one thing – I mean, I know you said before that this – I think you said this just wasn't necessarily a upper-middle-class thing. But I can't help thinking this falls upon Democratic lines. Like, the millennial kids that are come from blue states, as we said, and, had good educations. They're these little foodies. They're obsessed with this kind of stuff. But that, a lot of Republicans and conservatives still deny that climate change is an issue. So I kind of see this breaking down as the Democrats buying and blue states buying the organic and the, conservative Republicans who don't think climate change is an issue saying this is all a bunch of baloney.
Okay, so that – just so you know, we are a full-service shop here at Boston Public Radio, dear listeners. So that Marjorie's comment brings to light or brings to mind a piece in – or an online piece in a publication I don't know called 538.com, so forgive me for my journalistic ignorance.
Do you know what 538 is?
No.
538, does that stand for the number of electoral votes? Electoral votes there are, and you have to win 270
of those,
more than half of the 538
to win.
So it's electoral site.
Oh, I love it. So
this must be
about politics.
Yeah,
this website
was originally.
Okay,
yeah.
So forgive
me. Yeah.
See, of course, we seek and ye shall find should be our tagline.
Do you
here.
Believe I knew one thing that Nancy Kane didn't?
Oh my God,
the first time ever.
Well, that's
got
because we were obsessed with his blog during the election.
Elections. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so David Wasserman, folks, just like it sounds, with two S's, published a piece. Let's see, early this month, called Senate Control Could Come Down to Whole Foods versus Cracker Barrel. And then he charts like how people voted in the last few elections against Whole Foods locations and Cracker Barrel locations. So I leave it to Marjorie and to David, right, to ferret out this issue to say that, Whole Foods, just like the McDonald's campaign about no pink slime in our burgers, is a mass phenomenon. So I think we want to be careful about blue and red and Whole Foods and Cracker Barrel or Chick-fil-A and Starbucks, to use a different kind of locational plotting that's also been supposedly relevant to understanding politics in our fractured, constipated society. But in any event, I think the real issue here with Whole Foods right now is a strategic one. Can they reclaim their path-breaking market-leading position I wouldn't bet against John Mackey, and particularly against his co-CEO, Walter Robb, whom I've met and know something of. These are very, very smart, very savvy, and very, in my estimation, decent business leaders. One other P.S., let's not have our readers, our listeners not know this. Whole Foods caps the amount of compensation its executive team can get, cash compensation, at 19 times the average worker's salary. Wow. Just to put that in the context, if you look at the American Fortune 500 overall,
400
it's,
or something.
Well, let's count it conservatively, 250 times. And P.S., dear listeners, John Mackey decided about 7 years ago he was going to take no more money or stock or any other kind of compensation. I suspect he gets health benefits, more than a dollar a year. And that is true. So if you look at the SEC filings, there's these listings, right, where last year Walter Robb made about $800,000 in cash and another like $1.3 million. I believe his total comp was about $1.8 million last year.
Who's Walter Robb?
He's the co-CEO.
Okay.
And I've met him and talked to him and have a sense of him in a very different context, in a political context. In any event, so this company, and last really important comment, More than 80% of the stock that this company options that this company issues go to non-management workers. That's the exact reverse of the Fortune 500 average. So where 80% right of stock options issued go in public companies
to
go
the big
to
boys.
To a very small number of people, five, seven people, three people. So if you work at Whole Foods, I believe I've said this on the air, so forgive my repeating it. If you work at Whole Foods, you can go into the back office of any store and look at what they call the open book and find out what anybody makes in the company, all the way up the chain.
Ooh. Wow.
Hey, so this is a very interesting company, folks, and where values, they believe, are related to value.
Nancy, last thing for me, and this is, again, putting your historian hat on. While you're talking, I'm trying to think, you're very positive about that this will succeed, this program. I'm trying to think of even a moderately comparable historical example. The only one I can come up with is when the auto industry was in real trouble, not under Barack Obama, but a while ago, when the Japanese automakers were exploding, GM and everything was – there was a huge, as you know, Buy American campaign. It appealed, I think, a lot of the same sort of things, keeping our fellow workers employed and that sort of thing. Did that work?
Yeah, I mean, that became quite successful. That became a successful program for example, Ford, right? That became and it's clearly appealed to people's sense of patriotism and affected, from market research, affected buying decisions. Think of a couple of others, though. Think about the – we talked about the fossil fuel, the interest in having educational institutions divest money from fossil fuels. Or go back to the apartheid. The analog of that in the 1980s, right?
Example,
people stopped buying from companies that were investing. Or think about buy U.S. bonds during the Second World War. That was a huge value-infused campaign. A smash success. So consumers do vote.
Well, the grape boycott, too, under Cesar Chavez and United Farm Workers.
Right.
That's right.
So values-driven, values-driven consumption, right? And the campaigns for that have a good historical track record at a national level.
Okay, so raise your right hand, please.
I, Nancy Kane.
Swear that next time I'm here next week. I will read the poem I've written about Bono and Abraham Lincoln.
Yes, called Nancy and Iris. Those are the names of their mothers, respectively.
So you swear you'll do that?
I swear I'll do that. I should say to our dear listeners, the request forced me to go back to my poetry, which I haven't looked at in a couple of years, and there's all kinds of good stuff there. So I remain open to reading poetry on the air at any point.
Oh, next Tuesday.
We would love it. Yeah.
Nancy, it's great to see you.
Nancy Kane,
pleasure.
Thank you very much for being here. As always, Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership.